On our Earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda. I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage, changes the world. So honored to have Nikki Giovanni with us today, a word shaker, a world mover, a poet who arose like a wildfire when she was in her 20s, espousing a revolutionary blackness, empowering itself via a poetry that is direct, uncompromising, anti-rhetorical, thoroughly spiced with rage, humor, and an L-O-V-E that encompasses family and friends and the Black nation, with plenty of room there for romance and sex as well. Nikki, it's an honor.
It's my pleasure. Good, how are you?
That's quite a lead-in. Sorry.
That's a good introduction, well, thank you.
listen, I want to lay out a little legit. Well, thank you. Let's just stop right there. No. We got a lot ahead of it. I want to lay out a little agenda, if that's okay. The past.
Certainly.
I want to start with the past. We can talk about Cincinnati. That's because we both spent too much time there. I want to talk about soul and the interview or dialogue that you did with Jimmy Baldwin. In the writing, we can talk about anything, but the 100 asterisk best African-American poems is something that I kind of settled in that has a melange of your work. And if we have time and stamina, we'll unwrap the present and then go into the future. So the whole kit and caboodle. I'd like to start out with a little story of how we first met. I don't think I've told you this, Nikki.
No.
I met you the same year that you did that dialogue with Jimmy Baldwin. That was 1971. You were in London then, but I know you were in New York then too, because I was teaching at the Brooklyn Young Mothers Institute. It was a school for pregnant students. I was teaching English there. Yeah. And in Bed-Stuy, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, you had set up a little table near the subway and were selling copies of your chapbooks, Black Feeling, Black Talk, and Black Judgment. And I wonder if you remember a white boy with his hair in a ponytail and blue and white striped bell bottoms.
Gotta tell you, I don't. But I meet there's a.
Well, I remember you. I was.
Well, it's probably easier for you to remember some fool sitting there trying to sell books in the subway station than for me. I meet with a group of women. We are the Wintergreen sisters.
You. Nikki.
And they are about 20
oh,
of us. We've been meeting. We've been meeting for 35 years. I just want to share this. You said that, so I want to share this. And as we were sitting around the table having our morning coffee, somebody said, well, you know, Nikki, you've been doing this for 50 or 60 years. You know, how do you keep the energy going? And I said, it's very easy. I forget what I did in the past. I forget where I was. I forget where I signed. People have come up to me and said, do you remember? And I always say yes, but I don't remember. I forget the city. I forget it all, so that every time I walk on stage, it's new. And therefore, exciting to me. So what you're saying to me is like, oh, did I do that? And it's quite exciting. I'll be 80 soon. And if I were sitting on in Brooklyn someplace, and it's hard as hell to find your way around Brooklyn, if I were sitting in Brooklyn selling books, I wouldn't remember that I've done that. And it would all be new. And whoever stopped by to let me, to have me sign a book for them, it would be new. And I shared that with my Wintergreen sisters, because most of them are younger. There's only one who is older than I am. And they would say, that is the trick. Because if you don't remember, then you keep it new. And if you keep it new, it's always exciting. Every face is always exciting. Every time you see somebody, it's always exciting. And that shows on your face that the joy that you're seeing someone, that someone came to see you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's important. So it's interesting. And, you know, you can't find your way around Brooklyn, though. I lived in Manhattan. So if I was in London with Jimmy, I was working, but I lived in Manhattan.
No wonder you were right near the subway station.
You know what? I've never taken a subway.
Yeah, no wonder.
And of all of the things that I forget in life, I remember that. I
have never ridden. Oh my goodness!
Never taken a subway. I am geographically challenged, and that's the nicest thing I can say. And I think that if I took a subway, there's a song about that. And did you ever return? No, she never returned. And her fate is still unknown, Gloria. She may ride for, remember, Meet the Streets of Boston. She's a girl who never returned.
Never ever on the streets of Boston. Girl who never returned.
Now, if I got on a subway, that'd probably be the last, Nikki, of anybody that
I'm
you
gonna
saw.
Take you. Yeah. I'm going to take you on a ride.
I don't think so.
I'm gonna shadow you, be right with you, and not let you off. Okay, all right. It goes, the New York experiences. But make it new is a great saying. You know, that's what Ezra Pound said too. I know you at one point read some Ezra Pound and some T.S. Eliot. Do you remember that? You wrote.
Oh, I remember. Of course, I do. I mean,
so
Bob
you
Frost,
said your brain. You needed to fill up your brain with something. Okay. All right. Sure. Okay. Yeah, just to say. So listen, we got some other similarities going on here, you know. You were born in Knoxville. I was born in La Follette, Tennessee.
Oh. Okay.
You moved up to Cincinnati when you were about 5 years old.
No, my parents moved up to Cincinnati when I was about five years old. No, my parents moved me. I didn't move. My parents moved to Cincinnati, and they were kind enough to take me. And I have an older sister. So it wasn't my move. I was only a couple of months old, but they did that. So I can't take credit for what I didn't do. But I must say this, in all fairness to Cincinnati, no matter what else it is, we have the best chili. Skyline Chili is the best. And so whatever you do, whoever might be listening to us, if you
like
go to Cincinnati,
Skyline?
Go to Skyline. Five-way. I love Skyline Chili. It's worth going to Cincinnati for.
Listen, it's definitely is, Nikki, but I got to put up a little bit of confrontation here because I'm a Gold Star man.
Oh.
I'm a Gold Star chili man. Five-way.
It's a little runny. Don't you think Gold Star is a little runny? Well, we should have a contest.
I like the liquidity.
We should have a contest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I traveled with Abi Odun Oyewole of The Last Poets. He also is from Cincinnati.
Oh, I didn't know.
And he and I talked about our pasts back there. I lived in a little town called New Richmond that's up the river past Coney Island and River Downs there.
Right.
So, but he and I we talked about it, and you know, that town was so segregated, we could barely come up with a street that we had in common back in those days.
That's probably true. I lived in Lincoln Heights, and that's because of the problems at the West End. As you remember, after the Civil War, blacks moved into the West End. And the black participation in the Civil War was one of the major, as you know, battles, and one of the main reasons that the Union helped, that the Union won, and it was black people in the West End because it was considered not the best place to be. But then, when somebody finally realized that there was a lot of money to be made using that area, they kind of ran the blacks out. And we lived, and I say we, I mean my family moved up to Woodlawn, and then we moved to an area called Lincoln Heights. And Lincoln Heights was, I guess we must have had somebody, because there's always somebody white around. But for the most part, it was a black community. Very nice. And, you know, you grow up seeing things and not thinking them as being extraordinary. That's just the way things are. And when you get older and recognize, oh, this is not a good idea, then you fight against it. But Lincoln Heights was a nice place I am
exactly
and have and will continue to write about that. And I'm also writing a lot about Knoxville, which was also mm-hmm. a very segregated community, as you know. And the blacks in Knoxville lived in across mm-hmm. the creek, which is exactly what it was. And it was, again, mm-hmm. it just was not considered a good area. And they lived there until finally the University of Tennessee, which is up on the other side, as you know, needed or wanted, I should say, that land. And my grandparents lived in Mulvaney Street, lived at 400 Mulvaney. And the University of Tennessee decided they wanted it, and they pulled a, what do you call that thing? They took the land and eminent domain.
Oh, right,
and now
eminent
that,
domain.
That, yeah. Now that street is called Pat yeah. Summit Drive, which is really fun. I mean, I'm not against Pat Summit. I'm sorry she's dead and everything. But they got rid of all of the, well, there's just no blacks there. And I am writing the book that I'm working on. I've jumped yeah. to the future way before. It's a book called A Street Called Mulvaney. Because I think as a writer, if I don't write about it, who's mm-hmm. going to write about it? And I have wonderful memories of being in Knoxville, Tennessee, and being on Mulvaney Street with my grandparents. So, you know, right, that's what writers do. That's what we do. Is, and as I say, I don't remember a lot of things.
That's
I don't remember
do.
Walking
that's
on stages and stuff, but I remember summer spent with my grandparents.
Wonderful. And my granny lived in Harlan, Kentucky, and I remember spending my time there too. So that's another little bit of similarity we've got. But I know about 400 Mulvaney, whether it exists or not, because there is a street sign there commemorating the fact that the wonderful poet Nikki Giovanni grew up or lived, her grandmother lived there. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And there's a plaque there, and I'm so sorry that my grand... particularly my grandmother, who was much more expressive than my grandfather. My grandfather was very, very casual gentleman. He didn't express himself very much, but grandmother was one of those whoopee, yeah, look at that, you know, look at what my granddaughter did. And there is a plaque right across the street from where grandmother and grandpapa lived that said that I was there. And I think that it's good. And the book that I'm working on, which I yeah. am enjoying working on it, sometimes you cry, these things make you cry. And the train ride, I love trains, and I still love trains. And we would take, we being my older sister and I, would take the train down to Knoxville from Cincinnati. And it was just a wonderful experience. And then we got to grandmother and grandpapa, and then that was a whole level of joy. It really was.
I remember that train ride down right. down into Kentucky so far. Big steam locomotives, right? We're talking
yeah,
about the
so.
Old school trains, huge black steam and locomotives, big wheels just round and round. Big wheels keep on turning. You know, your grandmother helped you a lot, as a matter of fact. Now, you know, you wrote about how she came up. You know, there's some problems with this tech here, but you just go
oh,
ahead.
Oh, no, I'm
here,
sorry
Nikki.
About that. No, you know, the train, that was the LN. We took the LNN. There was also the Southern, as you know. Those two trains both came through Knoxville. But the LNN came down through Kentucky, and there was a white woman who I wouldn't know her from a hole in the wall, to tell you the truth. But there was a white woman who, as we came through Kentucky, about halfway through Kentucky, would board the train, and she sold ham sandwiches, and they were absolutely delicious. That's what she did. She walked, starting with the white train, part of the train, and then she walked all the way back. I think you could buy one of her sandwiches for like a quarter or maybe even less. And it was so wonderful because that's when Coca-Cola cost a nickel. And she would offer you, you know, would you like to buy a ham sandwich? And it was so wonderful when we had the money to, and I say we, because we, you know, just didn't have a lot of money, but we had the money, my sister and I, to buy a Coca-Cola and a ham sandwich. We split the ham sandwich. And it was so, and I remember that woman. I couldn't tell you what she looked like. She was just, you know, I don't want to say fat because I don't want somebody to think that's a negative because it's not, my grandmother was fat, but she was a big woman. And she came on to say, and she, I think she must have made her own mayonnaise because it's very hard. The only mayonnaise, and I'm not giving it a shout out, but the only mayonnaise that tastes like that is Duke's. Nothing else really tastes that mayonnaise-y. And I don't think so, but maybe I'm wrong, you know. But because grandmother made her own mayonnaise, too, you know.
No, just, I think you're
it's
right.
Just eggs, you know. But I remember the ham is white bread and a boiled ham. Because I don't know why anybody would do anything with a ham other than boil it. I do, you know how people say, oh, no, we bake this. You got to be kidding. Why would you ruin a perfectly good ham by you boil it? And you boil it slow. And then you let it cool. And it was just a wonderful experience. Yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely, lovely, lovely story. You know, your grandmother was a big supporter of you. I know you wrote some beautiful pieces about when you left home and went off to college. And I know one of them, you got kicked out, expelled.
Yeah.
And your grandmother came up and tried to talk the dean into letting you come back. Is that right?
Yeah, she wasn't successful. But we did get rid of the dean. And so when we got rid of the dean, I went back and graduated. So, you know, all's well that ends well. Grandpapa went to...
Oh, that's great.
It was Fisk University, and my grandfather graduated from Fisk in 1905. And I graduated in 1967. So I did graduate, and grandmother was grandpapa had passed, but grandmother was with us to see me graduate. So, you know, you have to take responsibility when you mess up, and I had messed up. It was my fault, but and I've written about that too. I left school
well, you may have
without
messed
permission.
Up. Yeah, you to, may have messed up.
And I left school without permission to go home. And when I say home, it's always Knoxville, to spend Thanksgiving with grandmother and grandpapa. And we had a tub. And I say we, 400 Mulvaney Street had a tub. And so grandmother wasn't expecting me. So now, instead of me being her granddaughter, I was, in fact, company. So we had the good dishes, and I helped set the table. We did all of that. And grandpapa was not well. And so she helped him bathe, and he always wore a tie. You know, I look at Downton Abbey, and I see the British people. They always wear, you know, the British men wear. And grandpapa always wore a tie. Then grandmother took her bath, and then I took my bath, and which always makes me cry, actually. I haven't taken a bath since. That was the last bath that I took because it reminds me of so much. So I shower, and I guess at some point, I guess if somebody saw me take a bath, they would know that the Lord has called and I'm going.
Wow. Wow. I want to take you back to when you went off to school, because you wrote a beautiful, beautiful piece about this. I think it was called A Revolutionary Tale. And I'd like to read just a little bit, because you tried various methods to keep from having to go to college to study social work. And it's one of the greatest pieces of writing. This is, you know, you back in your 20s here, you figured out by yourself that in a social work school, they'll put up with anything except heterosexual relationships. So you sent the administration a wire. Does anybody remember what a wire was back in those days? It's
I'm
a
sure
telegram.
They don't.
You sent a telegram, and I'm going to read it now. I'm reading your telegram now, Nikki. Please be advised. Stop. I have screwed. Stop. It was good. Stop. So there! Exclamation point. Yours in freedom. Stop, by the way, is the way you would indicate
a
period in a telegram, because there ain't no punctuation in a telegram.
I'm sure I didn't do that. But writers are, we tell stories, and that's what we're supposed to do. We make the story what we want it to be. Obviously, I would never be a good social worker, right?
Well, it goes on.
I'm not a social worker.
Right. you know, but your story goes on here.
Thank you.
You, when that didn't work, the story goes on, if you don't mind my saying so, where you proceeded to put just a little, now I know this wasn't you, I know this is all made up, I know that you really should win the Mark Twain Award for humorous writing, because what it says here that you did was put a little Drano, and I don't know if people even know what Drano is, but it was this caustic stuff, that the most caustic substance known to humankind. You put it in your pipes to clean them out, your plumbing pipes. You put a little bit of Drano in your roommate's coffee. And then she only went to the bathroom and never even mentioned it to you. This was Bertha that you give credit for. But you sent another wire to the social work school that said, please be advised, stop, have put Drano in roommate's coffee, stop, she lives, stop, I am a failure, stop, you must reject me. You did not want to go to school, Nikki.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's all funny. Oh, it's all, you know.
That's some writing, though. How you manage to mix revolution and humor, you see, like, you never lose your humanity in your poems, which I think is one of the reasons why you can sell 100,000 copies of a poetry book, which nobody can do, you know. Yeah. What do you think about humor then in poetry?
Oh, if you can't laugh, you know, you got a real problem. You have to laugh at something. And I do have a sense of humor, and I am comfortable with sharing that. And I also have strong feelings, but I don't, and have not, and will not ever think that my job is to teach people what to do. I am not, in any traditional sense of the word, a leader. I don't say this is what, you know, ought to have happened, or that's not what I do. I just try to tell the story. And there's always a story. I say that to my students. I just retired. I taught at Virginia Tech for 35 years, and I just retired. And I enjoyed it, but it's one of the early things I'd say to my students, you know. The main thing is that you are your first reader. So the first thing you have to do is, if it's supposed to be funny, you should laugh. And if you're not laughing at your own work, there's something wrong with it. So go back. That's the truth. Go back and see it and say, oh, okay, that was, I did that. And you have to enjoy. It's what we opened up talking about. You have to enjoy your life. You get this one time to go around. So there has to be some enjoyment. And enjoyment is not fun necessarily. It's that you have done your duty. You have done what you are supposed to do, and there's some love and we're talking about Skyline, and of course you're making a mistake of preferring Gold Star, but neither one of us has talked about Graders, which, remember Graders, which used to be so much better when they owned
ice
when
cream.
The Grader family owned, they sold it, and now you can see machines make that ice cream, and you can't eat it anymore. It's just a machine. But I make, by the way, very good ice cream, because I learned to make ice cream from my grandfather. And I absolutely love peach ice cream. And I'm the one that, when peaches come in August, you know, I'm your girl. It's a lot of fun. So you're just trying to find a way to go.
Oh, I'm coming down. That sounds
come on down.
Like, yes, Graders.
Come on down.
Well, you may say that you're not a leader, but there's certainly a lot of things that you did that, you know, certainly we look to as, you know, the first or the furthest out there, or striking out on your own, or a pioneer or something. I would like to talk a little bit about the NET program, NET preceded PBS, called Soul, with Ellis Hazlip, the producer there. Mm-hmm. And there's a new documentary called Mr. Soul about him that just came out. But you were regular on this hour-long show that in 1968, the Harris Poll estimated that more than 65% of African-American households with access to the show watched it on a regular basis. That's a number that you'll never hear that about. I couldn't believe it when I read it. But you were a regular on the show. You hosted the show, and then one time you were in a dialogue that became a two-parter with James Baldwin. You can leave me.
Yeah, the main thing about Soul was that I didn't work for Soul. I worked with, which meant at the end of the season, and we had a couple of seasons there, Ellis owed me. So he would say, well, what can I do? Because you've been working all season, what can I do? And, of course, everybody knows, as you do too now, I'm a foodie. And so he was thinking, oh, I'm going to take her to a French restaurant, and it's going to be really great. And I said, he said, well, what would you like? I said, I would really love to talk with James Baldwin. And Ella said, oh, I know Jimmy. You know, I can call him. I was just totally thrilled. And he called him, and in a couple of days, Baldwin called back. And he said, I'd love to talk to Nikki, but I don't have time to come to the United States. Would she mind coming to London? And I said, you know, to Ellis, I said, you tell Mr. Baldwin that I would walk to London to talk to him, you know, because I can't swim. People my age, black women my age can't swim because of segregation. But I said, I would walk to London. And I love London. And so we went over, we being my babysitter, or I guess you could call her my nanny. And I do so miss her. Her name was Debbie Russell. And Debbie... Yeah. Took care of my son, Thomas. And so the three of us went to London. Of course, Ellis went there. I have some photographs from that. And we met Mr. Baldwin. And that's where that conversation came from. But I am still surprised that I think it's on, what is that thing, Facebook or something. And a lot of people have come up, oh, I saw that interview. And I was surprised because, you know, it's been, I don't know, what, 40 years or so? And I was surprised. I haven't sat down to watch the whole thing, but I have watched or had to hear snippets of it. And I'm glad that Jimmy was 20 years older than I am. So what had made me so nervous about now, you know, getting your wish, is be careful what you wish for. I didn't want to embarrass my generation. I wanted to show that I was intelligent and that we were a good group, and it worked that way. I just wanted to hold my own, and I think that that I was able to do that. I wasn't picking at him, but I did, you know, want to say, well, the world has changed, and this is some part of what has changed with it, and I wanted to bring something new into our conversation. And the thing that I regret, Bob, most of all, is that both of us smoked. Both Jimmy and I smoked cigarettes. And I was so unhappy, mm-hmm, because it was shot in London. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the British are going to let you smoke. And what they do, because Jimmy and I both talk with our hands, and so you're using our hand, and there's no way to take the cigarettes out, because I wish there was a way to show the youngsters today cigarettes are a bad idea. And I'm sorry that I smoked. I had lung cancer.
Well, you just keep saying that.
Yeah. I am sorry about that. But the rest of it I thought was pretty good.
In those days, right?
Yeah.
You, are you kidding me? You killed it. It was a true dialogue that was going on there. You know, the smoking part, everybody was smoking back then, and you just have to tell them, don't look at that. You know, although the British TV is different from the American TV because they actually concentrated on your hands, what I think was a very marvelous aesthetic move on their part to see your and Jimmy's hand with or without a cigarette, usually without. but that was it's just an incredible show. Just to give you an example of how you held your own, you said at one point, I demand that a man act like a man. You were talking about black men and raising the children. And Jimmy said back to you, well, you can suggest it. And you said, suggest it? No, I demand it. And Jimmy said, I see your point.
It was great.
I mean, there you are talking to James Baldwin, 20 years older than you. You are holding your own.
I was going to say,
more than
a genius.
That.
As a matter of fact, I was very fortunate. Yeah,
totally.
We became friends. Mr. Baldwin and I became Jimmy and I became friends. And Jimmy was a good friend of a good friend of mine, Nina Simone. And so when he was in the States, of course, he and Nina were close. And I was close to Nina because I was working on her autobiography with her. But I was also close to her because we just became friends. And I'm not a difficult person. You may not know that because I'm talking over you half the time. But I'm not a difficult person to talk to. And working with Nina was easy for me because I'm not a singer. I didn't want anything other than her story. What is your story? And I'm sitting there, and I say sitting because most of I have tapes of her. And most of those tapes were made in her kitchen where we would sit. She lived up upstate, and I would drive up, and we'd sit down, and I'm a coffee drinker. And, of course, you're around a smoke. You're around a singer. So, and even though Aretha smoked, which was not a good idea, but Nina didn't. And so just sitting there, you're not going to smoke a cigarette or anything because you're not going to bother her voice. You know, you're not going to take a chance on that. And so sitting in there and drinking coffee and listening to her story was great for me. And I think I learned a lot from Nina. And I know that losing Nina was a great loss to all of us. She's a musical genius. And so we didn't have that problem, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the musicians you've known and that you refer to certainly did lead the way. And I'm just going back to soul for a minute. Some of the people that were on there included Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Al Green, Tito Puente, McCoy Tyner. Yeah, the jazz folks were there too. Max Roach, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Kool and the Gang. And then, you know, so, and musicians lead the way, but you brought the poetry there. I think you were the first poet to really present as a poet. And that's a role I've emulated with the work I've done for PBS and MTV. But for you to be there in the early 70s, as a matter of fact, I heard that they even offered you a job if you wanted it. Now, I know how you feel about jobs, but they offered you a job to host your own TV show, national TV, back in the day there. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I knew better than that because they'd end up firing me and it would be ugly and I would have been angry with myself. But one of the other, which is floating out there someplace, one of the other interviews that I did that I am really proud of was Muhammad Ali. And Mr. Ali became a friend. I didn't hang out with Ali the way that you hang out with Jimmy Baldwin, but it was so nice to be able to sit down and to talk with him because everybody was so proud, or at least the black community was so proud of the fact that he said he's not going to go to war. And I wanted my generation to have a voice in that, to let Mr. Ali know that we cared, that he was, we knew it was a sacrifice, but we also appreciated what he did to make a statement for all of us. And that was, nobody thought that Mr. Ali would come on Soul because he's Muhammad Ali, so he's a Muslim, and we have a show on television. You know, everybody said, oh, he'll never come on. And I said to Ellis, you know, Ellis thought that too. Ellis said, he'll never come. I said, Ellis, you have a camera, he'll come. But I had been working with Mr. Ali since he lost his belt because his publicist was Victoria Lucas. And Miss Lucas and I had worked together in presenting some shows that I was doing. And she asked me, she said, would you like to work with Ali? Because he needs somebody to, she didn't say front for him, but that's what she meant, to open, because he had to learn. Ali is a boxer. He's not used to talking. So he needed to learn how to walk on stage and have something to say. And if you've ever heard Ali speaking, there's a whole bunch of, there's a lot of tape out there. You'll see as he became more comfortable that he began to know, oh yeah, this is what I can do. And so I essentially, he opened for me and it was so much fun, but his wife liked me. And that was very helpful because Ali, you know, wouldn't fly. And so he always had his bus, but I didn't have time to go on the bus. So I was always flying. And so to get to know Ali and his wife, actually, and I had a son and I have a son. And Ali did not at that point have a son. So he kind of enjoyed when we're in the studio or on the stage or backstage, he kind of enjoyed Thomas, to my son's name is Thomas, because he never had a son. It's like, oh, this is what it's like to have a son. Oh, yeah, you're in for it. So it was very nice. But we had quite a few people who were, you know, you just ask, all they can say is no, you know.
Harry Belafonte.
Well, Harry was a friend.
Wasn't he on?
You know, we just lost. Yeah, he was a friend. And Julie, you know, we just lost him recently. But my sister and I, my sister had always wanted to go to London. Her name was Gary, and we were in London. But she has passed. But we were in London, and you know how London has those fogs, and you can't go anyplace. The planes are stuck there. And we were going to Paris because she had always wanted to see Paris, and I had saved up. And I said, oh, let's go. I'll take, you know, you want to take. I had taken my mother. I said, we'll take you. Come on, Gary, let's go. And we're stuck now at Heathrow because nothing's going to get out of Heathrow. And we're walking, trying to find something to eat. And I don't know what you know about Heathrow, but those were in the days where you just couldn't find anything. And Gary said, oh, my God, that's Harry Belafonte. And I'm saying, what's Harry Belafonte? She said, that man is Harry Belafonte. And it was his back. And I said, Gary, I don't see how you know that. She said, I would know that behind any place. So that's what she said. And so we ran to catch up with him to see if that's who it was. And it was Harry. And I said, hey, Harry, how are you doing? You know, it's Nikki. And he said, hi. And he, of course, they were going to get him out because he had to be in Paris. And somebody, one of the security guards said, are they with you? And Belafonte said, yeah, they're part of my group. And that's how we got into, because they had a special plane. And he was one of the few planes that took off that night. And it was so funny, but I got to know Harry, and he's just the sweetest man, and that's the truth. He really, you talk about duty. Mr. Belafonte did his, he's right there with Queen Elizabeth II in terms of doing duty. He did his duty, and losing Harry, Harry's sitting in heaven right now. He's a great man, and it we are all, United States is so lucky that we had Harry Belafonte among us.
So true. Thank you so much, Nikki. That's a beautiful tribute to Harry Belafonte. Another person who worked on the... Let me ask you, did you know Stan Lathan, who worked on Soul?
Mm-hmm.
Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, of course I know Stan.
Because, you know, he went on because he went on to direct the Deaf Poetry Jam generations later. But you, I bet, were the first poet he came into contact with.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine. I knew Stan from a long time ago. And he was, he's younger than I am, but who isn't? But he, again, was learning a lot from Ellis. And he learned a lot about, producing, how you put a show together. And of course, Ellis, and I need to mention this, and I hope that of all of the things you take out, I hope you leave this in, Ellis owes a lot to Novella Nelson. And when Ellis was invited to do Soul, he asked, his first person he asked was Novella, and I was the second person. And he talked to Novella, and he said, what do I need? And she said, you need a hairdresser, and you need a makeup artist. And that's the reason that Soul looked like, in our opinion, Ed Sullivan, because you didn't have people just coming on in T-shirts, and it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. They came on. They had been backstage. Their hair had been done. Their face had been made up. And that's what made Soul so special. Now, I look, for example, at Jeopardy. I look at Jeopardy almost every night. And there was a time that you looked at Jeopardy, and the men had on ties and jackets, and the women had on either dresses or jackets or something, but they were dressed. Now, of course, they have taken the black view of it, and they wear T-shirts and look like whatever they want to look like, which I think is a loss. I think they need to take something else back from us. But what we took from Ed Sullivan, and I say we, what Ellis took from Ed Sullivan, is he decided this is the way we present ourselves. And I remember the Delphonics, you're talking about some great kids, because Didn't I Blow Your Mind? It's just still a wonderful, wonderful song. And the Delfonics were just teenagers. And they came and they were backstage and they were really like not sure what to do. They were high school kids. And they got dressed. We had the makeup people and we had the suits on and they got dressed. And then they went out because they were, I think, 17. The lead singer, 17 or so. And it helped them relax. And they went out and sang, Didn't I Blow Your Mind this time? Which became, and well, it's a classic, actually. I was going to say Didn't it became I a big hit, but it's mind. More than a big hit. It's Didn't a classic.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, beautiful. Well, I apologize. I'm nobody can see me, but I'm admitting that I'm just wearing a t-shirt. But next time I'm going to dress for you, Nikki. I'm telling you right now, regardless of whether I'm being seen, whether the podcast is audio or video, you know. But, you know, that interview with I want to go back a bit to the interview with Jimmy, because it seemed in which you do look so beautiful. Not that you don't look beautiful now, you do. But your afro in London there, it was glowing. It was shimmering, you know. Yeah. It was your halo.
Yep. Thank you. Now you say I wouldn't have that much hair on my head now.
There was a little flirtation going on between you two.
No, I was like
Nikki,
a literary
girl. I thought there was a little flirtation going on underneath things. What do you think?
I think there was a little love going on. And I was very honored to know that Jimmy Baldwin had read me and had some idea of what I was trying to do writing-wise. Of course, read Jimmy. So I knew his work. And to sit there and talk to someone that you feel that close to, and I knew his brother David dated a friend of mine, Barbara. And so we sort of knew the family anyway. And it was just it was an honor to be sitting there talking to him. And it was a very relaxing, very, very nice thing. And, you know, Jimmy was a night owl. So we would do the show. You know, we filmed it. It took a while. And he would go out with his friends because he knew everybody all over the world. And he would go out with his friends. He wouldn't come back to the hotel until like, 6-7 o'clock in the morning. And then he'd go to bed. And then we didn't go to the studio until about 4 or 5 o'clock. So that we did that. And it was just, he was like an older brother. I don't know. There's no, not what you're implying. What it was like is I was more like a baby sister. And I think that Jimmy first thought his job was to teach me something. And as we kept talking, he realized that that's not his job. One of his jobs for my generation was for the older generation to listen. And I think I did my job on that one, because he did realize, I need to listen to what they're saying, to what they're trying to accomplish. And I thought that was very good. I think that we had an influence on him and his work.
And on the culture at large. You were speaking for a generation then that had, was revolutionary, and yet could sit up there in an intellectual discussion on the cultural show for Black Americans and speak for not being the leader, but you mean, because you're always speaking for yourself, you know, but you were able to describe the generational differences, as I mentioned earlier. Hats off, you know. Yeah. That interview, by the way, ended up with this little dialogue, this little bit. Jimmy says, "This person facing you is as alone as you are." And just talk about people in general, right? "This person facing you is as alone as you are." And you reply, "But that becomes your responsibility, isn't it? Doesn't it?" And Jimmy says, "Well, that's called love." And you said, "Yes, we agree." And at that, you both break out laughing. And you say, "Love is a tremendous responsibility." He says, it's the only one to take. There isn't any other. And you get the last word. You say, I agree. It's like you two are creating a poem right there in space. That was beautiful, Nikki.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So thank you. Well, you're so welcome. And where is the soul of today? Where is that show anywhere with all of these channels we got?
What can right we do? Right now, I don't know. I don't see that much TV, and I look at the same things over and over and over again because I'm always afraid I've missed something. So right now, I'm looking at Downton Abbey for the third time, and I am. I really like that show. And I haven't looked at I've seen Roots twice, but I could look at Roots again because Alex Haley was a dear friend, and he, as you also know, is a Knoxvillian. Alex Haley was a Knoxvillian. So it was good to it's good to see these things over again. And I read books. I treat books like I do music. I listen again and again because you hear a beautiful piece of music or a piece you like, and you don't want it to be just that one time. You want to hear it again and again, you know, until you know it or until you're singing it. And now I'm working with Javon Jackson. And Javon, I don't know if you know Art Blakey, if you remember, if you're a jazz fan, but Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers were a great group. And Javon was before Mr. Blakey died, Javon was the youngest saxophone player in the group. Then Mr. Blakey died. But he went on to start a school, a jazz school up at University of Hartford, which was wonderful. And I got to meet him, and he and I got to talking about what we loved, and we both loved spirituals. So we did an album together called The Gospel According to Nikki Giovanni. I didn't name it, they did. But we are now working on a couple of jazz pieces because there's some music that I love that, of course, Javon is about 10 years younger than I am. And so there's a lot of music that he doesn't know, that he didn't grow up with that music. You know, the folks who live on the hill or, you know, that kind of just sweet love song. And so that's what Javon and I are working on. And we'll be down in Atlanta in a couple of weeks at the Jazz Festival. And I can't sing, and I laugh about that all the time. I'm not a singer, but then, as I say, I know so many people making records who aren't that I don't feel embarrassed anymore. I just go out and sing my song. And, of course, he plays a beautiful saxophone. So I'm looking forward to that. And I consider that my third career, you know.
A lot of fun. You are a performer. You are the continuance of the oral tradition. You know, and you work with music. You've been nominated for Grammys in spoken words. And you put out this book called The 100 Asterisk Best African-American Poems. That's a wonderful book, and it includes a CD with it, which I think is just in keeping with what we're talking about here. You know, you wanted people to hear the poem as well as being able to read the poem.
You didn't read the last of it, though. It's 100 best African-American poems, but I cheated. And there was just something in me, the rebel in me would not allow me
asterisk.
To just do 100 poems. So I did 101 because I had to cheat on that. I did 101 poems because I kept running into poems that I love so much. And I enjoyed editing this book because, it gave me an opportunity to read and reread poetry that I love and that I wanted to share. And I also wanted to say the reason that it's But I Cheated, I wanted to say to the youngsters coming up, you don't always have to do what you're being asked to do. You can do some things your way, and you can get it done. Somebody will say, well, we only wanted 100. Well, you know, and you can sit there and smile and drink your coffee or tea, whatever it is you drink, and explain why it's going to be the way you would like for it to be. And I got the 101 poems in, so it was a lot of fun. Yeah. It's been great.
Beautiful.
Talking with you.
Nikki, would oh yeah. Well, have you got time to read some of the poems or one of the poems, some of the poems from that book or from any book for us?
Oh my! I mean, I have. Okay. Let me read my own. And this is a childhood poem. We've been talking about Knoxville and Cincinnati. This is a poem called Nikki Rosa. Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're Black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself and how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow, when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings and the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me because they never understand Black love is Black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy. So I'd like to, if you don't mind, close on that. It's been a pleasure. And I think you should try Skyline Five Way.
That's been a fantastic. I am going to definitely try Skyline Five Way, and I'm going to come down for peach ice cream.
And, yes.
I can't thank you enough. But I'm trying here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now, if it's okay, I'm just going to do my outro, and you can leave. You can bye-bye. Love you. What? Oh, I'm sorry. You can't leave. I'm getting the word. I have to read the credits, and then we can sign off here.
Okay, it works.
Oh, Nikki Giovanni, please keep writing. Please stay on the line forever. I love you. I am Bob Holman, and thank you all, audience, for listening to Poetry's Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes. Check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. The podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Roja with Ratapalix, artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. This podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts, New York State Council on the Arts, Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature.